Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, Senior Clinician in Rabbit and Exotic Animal Medicine and Surgery at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, Jenna Richardson. Thank you, Jenna. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Okay, well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this webinar. Where we're going to talk about diagnostic imaging and when that's useful to perform in the diagnostic workup of a rabbit. And we're focusing mostly on what's practical to do in first opinion practice, so radiography and ultrasonography. However, there is a little segment at the end looking at CT scans and when referral for this modality may be required for your patients. So the main plan, as I said, we're focusing on radiography and ultrasonography. And the whole point of, you know, diagnostic imaging and why we're performing it is to try and reach a diagnosis in as minimally as invasive a way as possible. And if we're not able to reach the diagnosis, then at least gaining more information which will guide the clinician towards any further tests that may be necessary. So when we're thinking, when do we perform radiography? I mean, certainly from a skull radiograph's point of view, I advise skull imaging in all my rabbits with dental disease. So at the initial presentation for dental related issues, then I think it is important to ascertain really as much information as possible. That will allow us to give the client, you know, ideas in terms of prognosis, in terms of how much management is going to be required, or indeed whether, you know, we can appreciate a cure with a particular ailment. We know with rabbits that the visible crown versus the reserve crown, or the root if you prefer to call it that, there's a great difference in the size of that, sort of like the iceberg effect, where what you see intraorally is a very small component to the length of the root area. So radiographs to assess the tooth root, check on the length, whether there's any elongation or impingement on the ventral mandible, any increase in the periodontal spacing, particular curvature of the teeth or lytic lesions, etc., etc. You know, all of these things are very important and things that we can potentially assess with radiography. And as well as dentition, you can also assess integrity of the jaw, you know, certainly whether there are any fractures, and have a look at the temporomandibular joint, see if there's alignment there, if there's any sign of arthritic changes, which, you know, especially in older rabbits, we're starting to see more and more. And in advanced diseases, not at the early stage, but certainly the tympanic bulla, you may be able to see changes to the tympanic bulla in terms of otitis media or destruction of the lateral wall of the bulla. But again, it's not quite as specific for looking at early changes with ear disease. And for the thorax, well, I mean, unfortunately, we're a little bit limited here due to the extremely small thoracic size of the rabbit patient. However, you can still define part size and positioning. Lung pattern, you know, it's a little bit tricky. But, you know, again, if there's obvious pathology, you're going to be able to pick that up. And that's certainly where radiology has its strengths. And in terms of the abdomen, so for a lot of these gastrointestinal cases, stasis cases rather, that are coming in, performing conscious radiographs, and that's something that we'll talk about in a little bit, but certainly performing conscious radiographs just to be able to have a baseline marker for stomach size, any gas build up in the abdomen, that's certainly very useful. And then because rabbits notoriously have quite a bit of fat in the abdomen, you know, especially these older bunnies that are maybe a bit more sedentary in their lifestyle, we find that the kidneys show up extremely well due to being surrounded by, you know, quite a bit of fat usually. So assessment of the urinary tract can be useful, and obviously looking for radio opaque structures with urolithiasis can also be very, very useful indeed. If you have a patient and you're not generally sure what's wrong with it, but something doesn't feel right in the abdomen, then obviously screening radiographs can be taken. And if we're wanting to assess the spine, obviously excellent for looking at bones, so spine and limbs, and again checking for any abnormalities. So quite a lot of uses that we can have for performing radiography. And I guess, you know, just knowing at which point to bring these into play is very important. Now the question is, do we sedate our patients to perform these radiographs? And in all honesty, I would say 90% of the cases I perform imaging on, I don't sedate, I don't GA, I do it all conscious. That said, I'm doing rabbits day in, day out. That's what's making up the majority of my caseload. So I'm very comfortable with my handling. I'm very comfortable with my restraint. And I would say if you're not seeing rabbits on too frequent a basis, and you're not too comfortable with having them, laid in lateral recumbency using sandbags, with a conscious patient that you'd worry would struggle, then a little bit of sedation really does go a long way. My general rule is that for the abdomen, I always perform those conscious. Usually these patients are coming in because they're in gastrointestinal stasis or because they've got mild bloat or even severe bloat. And in those cases, giving anaesthetic or sedation is really quite contraindicated. We're going to make that problem worse. So abdomen, I tend to always perform conscious. Depending on the patient, depends on my thoracic and my skull as to whether they're conscious or not, but usually to get lovely images of the thorax, some sedation is required because we need to keep those front limbs out of the way. And limbs, and if you want really nice square, put some time into getting the alignment correct, skull views, then a little bit of sedation can help with that. The picture here just shows that we've got a rabbit with the ears clipped. Get my little arrow here. So we've just clipped over the marginal ear veins. We do both sides and put Emla cream on both sides as well. The reason for that is just like with people, one side's often better than the other. So we place a little catheter, 26 or 24 gauge catheter into the marginal ear vein. And we would always do that in any patient that is receiving sedation or certainly anaesthetic as well. For sedation, I'll often use a midazolam and buprenorphine combination. It doesn't cause the rabbit to be fully asleep, but it will respond to loud noises and bright lights. But half a milligram, 0.5 milligrams per kilogram of midazolam, and 0.03 up to 0.05 milligrams per kilogram of buprenorphine is what I would normally give. And if you give it subcutaneously, then 10 to 15 minutes before the animal's sleepy. If you give it intravenously, it works that little bit quicker. So moving onwards. Certainly when we are thinking about radiography, what are we actually considering? Well, I mean, X-ray is really radiation, but it does allow us to create this 2D sort of photograph, if you like, whereby the beam is obviously passing through the body, and depending on which areas of the body it's going through depends on how much radiation is allowed to pass through to the plate on the other side. So obviously bone takes up quite a bit of the radiation doesn't allow passage, so we get a very white structure for the bones there. So in terms of the views that we can take, the skull views, I mean, in an ideal world, you know, if money is no object, then 5 skull views are the ones that are required. And in fact, I can't count because I've put 6 down there. So yes, in an ideal world, we would take 6 skull views. So the DV, Tends to be, the first one that we would think of, the dorsiventral. And then our laterals are right and left, our obliques. And then the rostrocaudal, which I don't think is done too much in practice, but certainly it's a very useful view for certain structures, and we'll have a look at those in a little minute. When it comes to x-rays of the skull, in an ideal world, if you work in a practice where they could charge per skull series rather than per plate, so have a set value, a set cost for doing all the views you need, then that might work out better for the client, and it means you can, in one sort of package deal almost, get all the views that you're interested in getting. So, thinking about our positioning first of all for a lateral. So this patient was a little bit sedated. You can see we've got an ear catheter, the green of the ear, with a bandage at this point here. And always remember, in any sedated or anaesthetised patients, those eyes are pretty prominent. So you always want to be putting some lacquer lube on the eyes to prevent any drying out. Now, in terms of positioning, the idea is that you want the ramus of the mandible on both sides to line up really rather nicely, so that we've got a nice superimposition. So one ramus to the other at the bottom. Always making sure you've got a left-right marker. And if we are sedated, some flow by oxygen is always a good idea. And really, it's all about trying to get a nice square image. To be able to get images where we're happy with. The other technique that I sometimes use is to put a sponge, so just a radiography sponge that you can buy, and I'll sometimes just tape the head actually to this so that the mandibles are sitting nicely square on the bottom of the sponge, with the sponge button up against the front leg there as well. And as we said, what we're aiming for ultimately is to have a nice parallel line for positioning. And what we're looking at really is to have a very nice clear image, where on this view here, if we just have a little look, we've got nice chisel shape of these incisors. You can see the little peg tooth sitting there. And the incisor root coming all the way back to this point. We can see if we follow the ventral mandible, there's no impingement on any of these reserved crowns coming down. And this ramus of the mandible here, both caudal mandibles are pretty nicely aligned, one over each other. And then a normal rabbit occlusal plane is to have this serrated occlusal table, where you can see the zigzagging of the cheek teeth at this point. And it's not so useful for looking at the tympanic bulla, but obviously this is our tympanic bulla back here, but what you can see and what you can appreciate is certainly if you had disease in one side, because it's a lateral and they're overlying, you're not going to know which of the sides are, affected. So I must admit, if I'm depicted by cost, then often I go for my oblique views rather than my laterals, because although the laterals look very pretty, the obliques can often give you that little bit more information. So for the positioning for an oblique, we're aiming to have obviously the mandibles out of alignment. And what that allows us to do is to have it so that we can clearly see one line of the ventral mandible versus one line of the other. And this could have been rotated a little bit more. It could be a little bit more oblique than what it's being. But what you can see is that we've got two of the cheek teeth here, where they're starting with occlusal pressure to basically grow out the bottom of the ventral mandible. So we would be picking this up on physical examination, because you would be able to palpate these bumps along the ventral mandible area. One more point just to say there is, when I'm positioning for these, I will often tape the rabbit's ears and use the ears to sort of rotate the head, rather than actually taping the jaw itself, because with all the hair on a rabbit's face, when you try to put tape on, it usually tries to slip. Whereas by putting the ear that's not nearest to the plate and taping that and just pulling it, that helps to rotate the head quite nicely. And again, that's very easy to do on a sedated patient. So here we can see just another slightly more oblique, and this is very nice. You can quite clearly see along the lower line of this mandible here. And again, you can see with the obliques, get my little line back, we've got one tympanic bull over here and we've got another one here. Now, there are structures underlying, but it still allows us to see that little bit clearer than the previous view. And just one oblique here where we've got incisors after being removed, which shows just how long those incisors make those, both the maxilla and the mandible. And then this bottom right one here was used for dental staging. So this is one of these cases where I said, you know, for starting a case, I would definitely take radiographs to know what we're dealing with. So what I can say to my owner is these incisors are not meeting correctly. They're butting up against one another instead of the lower incisor sitting nicely behind the upper. This is always going to cause a problem. So really, we need to be removing these. However, if we're removing them, bear in mind, we're not solving the problem with the cheek teeth. We've got a lot of widening of the periodontal space back here. We've got some lysis around the reserved crown. We've got some elongation at the ventral mandible as well. So ultimately, this is something that we really need to be performing a cheek teeth dental on, removing the incisors, but that rabbit will not be cured of its ailment, it will be management only. And then we're managing client expectation, whereas if you'd not taken these radiographs, you're not able to tell them how severe a condition can be. For the dorsoventral, and again it comes down to what we're looking at in terms of our positioning. So just jumping on to the next slide, what we're aiming for is symmetry. So you can see the little legs, the front legs here that we've got, you know, one leg to the side here, one leg to the side here, and we're aiming to have balance with our patients. A little bit of downward pressure just behind the eyes really, just to extend that neck so we're getting a nice clear view. Normally in my awake patients, I place a sandbag over this point and that helps to stretch that neck out as well. And then you can see we're just aiming for, again, beautiful symmetry with collimation as well. And it's sort of a spot the difference then when we're examining these radiographs. So we're looking at basically our incisors. So if we just have a look here, so we've got our upper incisors here, we've got our little peg teeth. This is the upper first premolar, and it's the only one of the cheek teeth on either side there as well where they're not superimposed with other structures. And then we're coming back to along the mandible. Obviously we've got the tympanic bulla here and here. And so, you know, a very nice view for particularly looking for any changes with the symmetry of a structure. And this is just a patient who's obviously a well-behaved patient, but nonetheless it's a conscious view. And you can see this is the x-ray that we've taken from her with, you know, the sandbag just starting to come into view here. But nonetheless, we've been able to extend that neck nicely and get a very lovely picture there as well. Let me continue on. So this case, again, just an example of where dorsoventral can be very useful. So this particular rabbit came in with a 5-day history of inappetence. It was a referral, and the fracture had just been missed because no x-rays had been taken. Now, on physical exam, it was actually quite difficult to palpate this fracture, even though it looks quite obvious. But, you know, a quick x-ray, conscious x-ray, and we would have found that problem and the patient would have been dealt with a lot sooner than what it was. So what we've got here, obviously, this is a normal skull view. And you can see the right mandible on this side coming all the way back here. Whereas on this view, what you can hopefully appreciate is this portion here. We've got a sort of rostral and lateral displacement of the caudal half of this right mandible. And that ultimately leads to, you know, this mandible being shorter, so we've got mandibular shortening. And it's really the angular process here of the right mandible that we've got this lateral deviation on. And then we've got complete luxation of the temporomandibular joint as well. And I've got another view that shows that even nicer in a few slides' time. What we can say, however, is that the cheek teeth, so on this side here and also on this side here, are still in good alignment. And the incisors still appear normal in their appearance as well. So we can conclude that we've got a right sort of mid-complete mandibular fracture with temporomandibular joint luxation. And again, very clear and easy to see on this view. And then the other skull view to discuss is the rostral caudal. Now, very often in conscious patients, this is where I would make use of, for a very short period of time, the tonic immobility, which is a very stressful thing for rabbits. So if we're doing it, we weigh up the pros and cons of doing it, and for as short a time as possible. But the majority of these I am sedating to get these views so that we're getting nice radiographs with minimal stress to the patient. But if we're doing it conscious, then usually I would use a sponge at this point here to basically flatten against the top of the head, and then have towels rolled up so that they're in a bit of a cradle type situation where they're leaning one against into a little groove, so one on this side, one on the other side, and they're secure and can't tumble or roll or anything silly like that. What the rostral caudal allows us to do is to basically get a picture where you can nicely see the temporomandibular joint. So again, just having a look on this side. This is the patient that had the fracture we've just seen. You can quite clearly see the temporomandibular joint on this left side nicely intact. And on this right side, it's completely luxated and out of joint. You can also see this caudal area of the mandible nice and normal on the left, and quite a clear and distinct fracture on the right as well. So another very nice way of getting these images and therefore making a diagnosis. So the skull views, if I'm pushed, then an oblique is definitely one I always want to include, as is a dorsoventral. But in an ideal world, we'd be doing our laterals and we'd be doing our rostrocaudal as well. And although I'm quite used to taking conscious views, I think if you're not taking a lot in practice, then for the safety of the animal and the quality of your images, then a little bit of sedation really goes a long way for these patients. Right, so for our thorax, the right lateral thoracic view is really the most common lateral view taken. And It kind of optimizes the visualization of the thoracic skeleton, the heart, and also the lung fields as well. Now in rabbits, the trochea ends in about the fourth intercostal space. The lung parenchyma is filled with air, and that means obviously that the blood vessels and the wall of the bronchi are more radio opaque, so they show up that little bit better on radiographs. But the problem really that we have with the lungs is the radio opacity varies greatly between the inspiratory and the expiratory views. And the ideal is to take inspiratory views, but because rabbits can breathe pretty rapidly, really to ensure this, it comes down to a bit of pot luck or to actually have them intubated so that you can perform IPPV, and you know that may or may not be necessary for your patient to actually anaesthetise them enough. And if you are looking at chest views and you're wanting to assess the lung field, it's because they've got some kind of dyspneic episode. So again, you know, anaesthetising them might not be the in their best interest to do. So the normal rabbit lung, I mean, if we're taking this on an inspiratory view, it should show a sort of light pattern as well as the blood vessels arising from the base of the heart. And if we just have a little look, obviously we've got our windpipe coming down, so trachea coming down. We've got our heart outline here. We've got our diaphragm at this point. We've got our thoracic aorta coming up and running along at this point. We've got our caudal vena cava running at this point here, and often it'll narrow a little bit just at the area of the diaphragm and the caudal thorax. And then further back, you can just see the stomach at this point here, and a little bit of gas in the stomach up at this level also. So the dorsoventral for the thorax, getting conscious dorsoventrals is fine, but you have to be having those limbs forward and out of the way, and that's the same with the you know, the laterals as well. That you have to really pull forward those front legs so that we're not getting the soft tissue structures overlying. And obviously, pulling limbs forward in a conscious rabbit, you know, they can resent that and not be happy. So my technique is I'll sit a towel down on the radiograph. On the plate, and basically have a little sort of sandbag at their bottom so they feel sort of fairly secure, sandbag over the shoulders, and just gently bring the legs forward so that they've got grip on the towel and they're more likely to sort of sit in that position just for a very small amount of time. To have a sandbag over the shoulders, you've got to roll it forward onto the neck, otherwise obviously you'll be obstructing the cranial thoracic area, which sort of defeats the point. So it is important to pick your patients well when doing that, so they're not going to panic and so forth. So what can we see here? Well, obviously we've got a wee microchip there, just like you would often see in dogs and cats. We've got our heart outline. You can see the scapula, the line of the scapula there. So even if we're pulling these little legs forward, we've still got the shoulders overlying. We've got caudal lung lobe down here. We've got the diaphragm running here. Stomach's underlying at this point here. And, you know, what we're basically trying to assess is heart position, heart size, and also whether we've got a clear lung that we can see as well. So similar as you would for your dog and cat. So we don't need to dwell on that too much. There's no sort of rabbit specific things we must think of for these views compared to dog and cat. So say that we have a dyspneic patient that's coming in, and we don't want to anaesthetise, we don't want to sedate because they're very high risk, but we want to take radiographic views. Then having a conscious horizontal beam might be the option. And this particular patient came in blue, cyanotic, dyspneic with some open mouth breathing periodically. So it was on oxygen to stabilise. And we took a little x-ray just of it in a sitting position, which is why you can see the elbows overlying the thorax there. And, you know, we got enough information here to confirm what we were already advising to the owner, which was euthanasia on humane grounds. And they went for that. We did a post-mortem, and this was an older entire female, and she had what we thought was a primary uterine neoplasia, most likely adenocarcinoma. And on post-mortem of the thoracic field, we had pleural effusion with nodular sort of infiltrative lung lesions throughout, which we thought were secondary metastatic spread. So what else is the thoracic views useful for? Well, here we've got two views. One where you can see that limb just not being pulled far enough forward. These were conscious views that were taken using a sandbag just to keep the limbs forward and out of the way. The second view is the same animal where I managed to get the limb pulled forward. It was actually the limb nearest the plate that was the one that was overlying the image, which is why we'd missed it on the first view. So what we can clearly see is that there is a big increase in opacity in the mediastinal area, stretching all the way back, and perhaps could argue is displacing this caudal border of the heart as well. So the most likely reason that we're going to see for views like this is a mediastinal mass, and thymoma certainly is the most common that we're seeing in rabbits. Now the thymus in rabbits is persistent throughout life. It doesn't regress, unlike in some animals where it regresses with age. And up in the mediastinal area, there's also a lot of fat usually as well. Now this particular case came as a referral from a referral centre where they had confirmed the diagnosis of thymoma, and it came up for treatment for that. Now we do a lot of imaging up here, we do a lot of CT, so this radiograph here, this was the CT image of that animal. And what we can see here is we've got the heart outline at this point, we've got some lung, scapula up here, another scapula there, and the vertebrae, but all of this is mass. If we're thinking of where we're taking that cross section from, you can see on this view here, so cross section at this point, and so a little bit of lung still functioning, which is why the animal was still with us, but a huge amount of thymoma taking up most of this chest cavity. So this animal actually underwent, she's called Boo Boo, and she underwent radiation therapy treatment for her thymoma. She was a 10-year-old rabbit. She underwent 5 rounds of RT treatment, which shrunk the tumour considerably, such that she's had currently another 7 months of good quality life without evidence of the thymoma. However, it was a palliative treatment, not a curative. So this was the mass before on the side here. And at the same location of CT, this is her 50 days post-treatment. And you can see she has lung again, small amount of thymoma left, but majority of it has gone. And the hope is that she will live out her days before that regrows and causes her problems again. So that's a little bit of an aside. But moving away from thorax now, and to abdomen. So what can we say about our abdominal radiographs? Well, they're probably the ones I take most commonly, usually for assessing gut stasis cases and making sure that I've not got a blockage, or if my assessing the degree of bloat that I may have as well in a patient. And we can see that obviously we've got our diaphragm up here. The diaphragm's pretty long in a rabbit and it slopes quite a lot. And in the cranial part, we've got our liver. And then, obviously, mostly on the left-hand side, we have our stomach. So the caudal border of the stomach running down at this point, and it kind of curves over towards the duodenum at the pylorus. What else can we see? Well, kidneys. So we've got the right kidney, and the right kidney is always cranial to the left, and you can clearly see the outline at this point. Left kidney is over in this area here, and they're usually nice and straightforward to see because of the fat that's around them. Can also see, so we've got cecum. This is the outline of cecum here, and all these little gas bubbles within the cecum. And this is quite a fat rabbit, so we've got a little bit of fat in the abdomen as well. And the same on this side here. And that's pretty much what we can see in the abdomen on the DV view. Obviously, if there's pathology, then we might be seeing that as well. So just to look at a couple of examples of DV images. So this is a gut stasis rabbit that came in. And this caudal border of the stomach is certainly much more enlarged than it should be. We've got a little bit of a gas cap there. And you can see lots of ingesta as well in the rest of the GI tract, some gas bubbles, nothing that suggests to me that we've got a blockage, but certainly that stomach's enlarged, and that's going to be uncomfortable for the patient. So this was admitted, given IV fluids, given analgesia, and within a few hours that stomach started to empty. We started it on prokinetics once we were happy there was no blockage, and it went on and did very well. And again, just another view showing that sometimes with gut stasis cases, you can take a view and okay, we've got a little bit of enlargement of this stomach, certainly not as bad as the previous. But again, you can clearly see one outline of a kidney here. You can see one outline of a kidney there. But this was a more long-term case, so that cecum is just not quite as full as it could be either, and not quite as much fill. So, you know, sometimes you take these abdominal views and they're more unexciting. And to be honest, unexciting I'm quite happy with, because to me that just tells me keep with the plan, keep with what I was doing, keep with the supportive care. And very, very few of these cases are ever surgical. Okay, so the lateral abdomens, I get a lot of information for these. And I do like them, I must admit. So again, we've got caudal border of the stomach, a little bit enlarged. Now this could be that we've just eaten, or it could be that we're a little bit full and starting to become dehydrated. And it was the latter in this case, it was firm on palpation. This was just a general gut stasis case. And the cecum also was firm on palpation, and that was because food wasn't moving through, so it was getting dehydrated. And then we had quite a lot of feces within the colon, the descending colon there. So I knew that this is a case that was likely going to respond quite quickly to medical treatment, and certainly no indication for surgery. So sometimes when you take a radiograph, it can be to confirm that you think, you know, you know what the problem is. And certainly this animal was very painful on palpation of the bladder. The bladder felt enlarged and thickened. And normally I would go for ultrasound, but I couldn't get an ultrasound slot. And I wanted to make sure that I didn't have a stone in the ureters. So I took a quick x-ray, just a lateral view, and what we can see is this bladder is just absolutely full of what is most likely calcium carbonate crystals. But it was a very overweight rabbit. It was in gut stasis, but likely secondary to the discomfort from the bladder. So in this case, this was diagnostic to me. And we needed to start on a plan of weight loss for the animal, of promoting exercise to help with urine voiding, low calcium diet, and obviously start the treatment for the bladder disease as well. Just another example of a gut stasis. I think this is the same view as before, where we've got this generalised, lots of ingesta, but everything's just sitting there quite static, but no sign of gas distension, certainly not a surgical emergency in this case. And again, we can just see that we've got some dehydration just starting of this stomach here. So this was very early stage. We've got liver up in this area here, we've got stomach in this area, we've got the outline of one kidney just here, we've got another outline of another kidney at this point, left kidney, and then the cecum, which is mostly to the right and the midline area. Okay, and we can see in this one the stomach enlarged, it's got gas in it. Again, very fat rabbit, not much else going on in here in terms of food quantity, there's not a lot. And this was a rabbit that actually had ingested a lot of hair. And in this distal descending colon, you can see maybe this chaotic appearance of the fecal pellets. They were all very much strung together with hair. And we had a bit of an outflow obstruction actually from at the pylorus, which with hydration we were able to clear that and shift it down. But again, this took a couple of days of supportive care. But again, seeing this, I wouldn't think surgical. I would think support the patient, rehydrate, analgesics, and then decide. So not quite a true emergency here in terms of surgery, but getting to that point. Where we are seeing things and thinking emergency is something like this. So this is one of these cases where you have to be deflating the stomach You have to be getting your patient stable, and if we're not getting any response over a fairly short period of time, then this would be your surgical candidate. So what we can see is real extension of this caudal border of the stomach here. Gas cap, very obvious. Not much else going on back here, not a lot of ingesta getting by, and this will be extremely painful for the animal having a stomach this large. I certainly wouldn't be sedating for any of these views. These are ones that we can get conscious. And in cases where the stomach's so huge, this is examples where maybe a horizontal beam might be useful rather than restraining the patient in lateral recumbency. Cecal bloat, this is very rarely, if ever, surgical. These are usually medically managed cases where you can see the individual sections of the cecum, with gas, so that we're able to see the outlines of each segment quite clearly. And you can see how displaced it is, that it's sort of risen up that little bit as well. And again, these are very painful conditions for the rabbit. And one where the cecum's in a more normal position, but again, just empty of food pretty much and full of gas. And little stomach, very small stomach there. Not much going on, a little bit of fat down here. You can sort of see an outline of one kidney at this point, perhaps the caudal border of another kidney up there, and what looks like fat and bladder around this area. But this cecum, very much needs to have some fluids, needs to start with some prokinetics to try and get that gas shifting. And just another view of that is this one. And again, you can see cecum mostly to the right, but just this would be very, very painful for this rabbit. But again, not a surgical case, and that just confirms that to you with having taken these radiographs. And when they're very severe, we can see them. And this is obviously one where the prognosis would be a little bit guarded at this point, just because of how severe this is. But again, it's still not a surgical case per se. This is one that, again, you'd want to try and medically manage that. So moving on to the spine. And unfortunately, spinal trauma is something seen all too commonly in pet rabbits. And they're relatively delicate skeletons. They account for a mere sort of 8% of the body weight. And so they can often be victim to these powerful movements of the hind limbs. So good handling techniques is really very important. Using bunny burritos, wrapping them in towels for the fractious animals. And definitely good analgesia and anaesthetic combinations to prevent struggling associated either with the performance of a procedure or the recovery from a procedure. And the spine in rabbits, so it's naturally curved, and the ribs are sort of flattened. Vertebral formula of the rabbit, so C7, T12, L7, S4, and C15 to 16, depending on the rabbit. But of the main area where we're seeing is the lumbar area for seeing fractures. And the most common place is sort of between the L6 and L7, so the lumbar 6 and 7 vertebrae. So for thinking about positioning, really we're, for the DVs, we're aiming to have these spinous processes very much central, so lying all the way centrally. And then for the lumbar transverse processes here, you can see that we're trying to get those nicely balanced and equal so that we're not rotating. And on the lateral view, so you can see that we've got our transverse processes here. We're looking at the intervertebral space as well, the disc space. And you can have a look up at, wings of ilium up at this level here. And look for any sort of new bone formation, if there's any bridging and new bone sort of scooping up between vertebrae. Because certainly if you have a patient who's previously been keeping themselves pristinely tidy at the back end and suddenly we're having dirty bums, it might be you've got spinal pathology and it's painful to turn and groom in that area. So, even if you're doing an X-ray to look at, say, stomach size, or you're having a look at kidneys for any urolithiasis, have a look at the spine, don't ignore it. And if there is pathology, then if you think it's something that's likely to be painful, then maybe some tramadol, for example, is a more long-term kidney-friendly option rather than non-steroidals. Here we have a patient where we've got scoliosis of the sort of mid to caudal area of the thoracic spine there. And actually, this little bunny, she's had gut stasis on and off for a few years, which may or may not be related to the spine. Her mobility is good. She's getting old now, so occasionally the owner reports that she scuffs a back leg, but primarily she jumps, she hops about, and behaves like a normal bunny. But again, this was found almost as an incidental finding. But if we think it's causing her pain, in her older years now, she's on tramadol, which the owner feels has a bit of an effect. If it's not doing harm, but it might be doing good, we sort of go with that, and give the medication. Okay, so to get good quality limb images, this is where I do sedate, or do a general anaesthetic, because otherwise you're likely to have problems with your patient struggling. And when taking your limb views, it's exactly really the same principles as when taken in dog or cat. The forelimb, however, has 5 digits in rabbits, and the hind limb has 4. And the gait is plantigrade at rest and digitigrade when running. So this may influence how you choose to fixate your fractures, bearing in mind that they're quite flat-footed on the back feet. So this image just shows a little bunny that had a calcaneal fracture, which we pinned to replace, and it went on and did very well. And then just a sort of reminder when it comes to limbs that the importance of always taking more than one image as well, because we have this view here, which is a giant rabbit, continental giant, that came in with a femoral fracture, as they do. We see them very commonly. And on initial view, you think, oh, well, it's maybe not too bad. On the next view, we can see just how bad this fracture is. So it was a displaced femoral fracture, not quite open yet, but it required external fixation. So, even if a fracture looks obvious, treat it like a dog and cat. Definitely take more than one view, get a true idea of how it's doing. And this picture here just shows a little bunny that came in with obviously a very nasty comminuted spiral fracture of the tibia fibula and of the right hind limb. And it was a Sunday night emergency, and I am no orthopod. I like my soft tissue surgery, but I wouldn't claim to be an orthopod at all. But I obviously knew that I couldn't leave a limb like this overnight. So I sedated my patient, which I was happy to do because it was previously a healthy rabbit. I took my views, clipped it up to make sure that, because there was one area where I thought it might have gone open, but it hadn't. So I was happy with that. So I basically splinted it and then took my radiographs to make sure that my splint wasn't doing more harm than good. I just used a bit of guttering splint in an L shape and bandaged to it. And that stayed on for 2 days until we could get a slot for repair where it had an IM pin and X-fix. And it went on and made a full recovery. But sometimes radiography for check-in to make sure that your splint placement is good is obviously a very sensible precaution to be taking as well. Other uses that are more for a checking point of view. So certainly nasogastric tube placement, and you may struggle to see it on this one, but let's have a little look. We've got a little tube running all the way down there, curving down, and the bottom of the tube is here. And this is a nasogastric tube. I'd be pulling that back ever so slightly so it wasn't quite as far in as what it is. But again, making sure that it's not in the windpipe, making sure you're happy it's in the esophagus going to stomach, that is important. And then if you're placing intraosseous catheters, I always do a quick x-ray just to make sure I'm happy with my placement of those as well. I'll be honest, that's more for my rodent species, because in rabbits, I'm very rarely defeated on IV catheters. And what other uses do we have for radiography? Well, we can do contrast studies, and certainly having a look at the nasolacrimal ducts can be very useful, looking for problems with the upper premolar or the upper first incisor, because both of those roots lie right where the nasolacrimal duct passes. So if we've got swelling to either of those points, then we can see here upper premolar and then incisor root. So actually at this point we've got a restriction and narrowing here, and that's because there's an incident with this root, and you can see that we've not got a nice chisel shape to that upper incisor, whereas we got a bit of a wonky one to that lower, and they're butting against one another. So this is putting back pressure on this incisor, and it's pushing against this tear duct at this point here. So placing a nasolacrimal duct cannula, well, always use your local anaesthetic drops. You want to tent out that lower eyelid and have a look at the medial canthus. Usually given a little rub just in front of the medial canthus, just rostral to it, allows the duct to open and material bubble back. And then you're just inserting your cannula in a ventromedial manner and flushing with a little bit of sterile saline, and then you can instill your contrast agent. So we've got a little picture of that. So you can see there is your little slit for your nasolacrimal duct punctae, and you're just inserting your cannula at that point. And again, just an example, you can see the DV view. Let's bring our little arrow so you can see it transversing. There's our upper premolar, and you can see how if there was a problem there, it might affect it, and then running down towards the root of the upper incisor as well. So the other reason that we use radiography is for barium studies. And generally for our barium studies, the time frame that we're giving is these ones that are listed here. And so what I normally do is I will take my conscious views first. Everything's done conscious, but I should take my plain views, I should say, first, and that allows my baseline. And then I feed some oxbow, where I mix some barium into it, and I take my images straight away. Now, what we would expect is for the stomach to begin emptying within about 15 to 30 minutes. So if you think how long it can take to syringe feed oxbow, you know, up to 10, 15 minutes, it's no surprise that that stomach's already starting to empty. And you can see on that left view already that duodenum is starting to get material going into it. Now, timings-wise depends on a busy surgery, busy clinic. But here we can see a view taken almost an hour later, and the small intestine transit times 40 to 60 minutes. So, you know, you'd expect it to be, as you can see there, like a bit of a ribbon working its way through to the small intestines. Now, the cecum should fill within anywhere from 1 to 3 hours. So this one is 4 hours post, and what you can see is that the cecum has already filled. You can tell this patient's been unwell because of how small this cecum is. But the cecum has already filled, and we've already got ascending colon with some formed fecal pellets here that are looking a bit like a string of beads. And I always take a DV, and I always take a lateral view with these images. After the 4 hours, then usually these patients are in because they're not well, so we take one the following morning. And what you can see with this patient is that we were resolving the stasis, but we've got a very chaotic, irregular-sized faeces, which is quite often the case after we've resolved or improving a case of gut stasis. You can see the stomach's pretty much devoid of barium at this point. Cecum still has quite a lot within it, but most importantly, the colon is filled with all these fecal pellets with barium in it. And then a day after, if we've got a problem, we might see something like retained material in the cecum, so delayed emptying. And again, this shows a large bowel dysfunction, and you can see the sort of dehydration with each of these sort of haustra being easy to visualize with each of these segments. And then just a close up of the sort of chaotic nature of the descending colon into the rectum with all of this material here as well. So that leads us on to our ultrasonography, but hopefully from the radiography you can see lots and lots of uses in rabbits, and certainly we use it a lot. And ultimately, if you can use it for dog and cat, there's no reason why you wouldn't be using these images, these views for rabbits as well. So moving on to ultrasound, and I reckon that for most of us this is really quite an underutilized tool. But once you have invested in a machine at your practice, then the cost of performing ultrasound is really your time. And I found when I was a new grad, the extent of my skills were for PDing, so pregnancy diagnosing in cattle, and then occasionally for PDs in bitches, and then detection of pyometras. Thankfully, I've come a long way since then, and I do really enjoy ultrasound now. And in terms of the technicalities behind it, well, it's a bit out with the remit of this webinar to go into that. But in a nutshell, we're using these sound waves to create real-time images of our soft tissue structures. And when you read ultrasound reports, there's a lot of terminology associated, and the most commonly used terms are sort of mentioned here. So homogeneous is when we discuss the appearance of a structure, meaning it's uniform and with an apparent regular texture. So, for example, a healthy liver, we would say. Hyperechoic is if the structure of the organ you're looking at is brighter when compared to the surrounding anatomy. And hypoechoic means obviously the opposite. And when we have shadowing, this is usually because the ultrasound waves have not been able to pass through an object, for example, bone, or in the case of the rabbit, gas in the large bowel, which is usually quite inhibitory for regions of the abdominal ultrasound. Okay, so to be able to get any value from ultrasound images you're obtaining, really you need to clip the fur in a decent amount. And I've read in a couple of books that if you thoroughly wet the fur coat with ultrasound gel, then you can get a diagnostic image. But I really haven't found that to be the case. I find it's important to have good contact between your transducer probe and the skin of the patient. And I therefore make a very generous clip. However, if I am doing this, firstly, I make sure the owner's aware. And secondly, if you've got a sick patient, you have to then provide them with suitable heating. And I certainly wouldn't do it if my owner wasn't willing to keep their outdoor rabbit indoors, especially if it was winter when I'd done the clipping. So you have to be sort of aware of these considerations as well. And I find generally, sedation is rarely required for rabbits. So rabbit, guinea pig, chinchilla and ferrets are generally performed conscious. For your small wriggly patients, then perhaps sedation or more lightly inhalation anaesthetic may be required. And your nurse should be restraining the rabbit in a vertical manner, so like that previous image holding for being clipped. And remember that, having a rabbit on its back, it is thought to be very stressful for it. The process is known as tonic immobility, and so therefore we do, where at all possible, try and avoid doing that. And also, don't feel that you have to do everything in one sitting. You can give the animal a little break before continuing, just to try and reduce the stress that's involved with it. So when do I use ultrasound? Well, in emergency cases, for your dyspneic patients, I'll pop a probe on the thorax to check for, a pleural or a pericardial effusion. With pleural effusion, I'll usually drain this conscious in my patients with the rabbit in sternal recumbency in one person, holding with a little bit of downward pressure over the shoulders, and someone with downward pressure at the rump. But for the abdomen, I certainly can check for free fluid, and that's often crucial in acute cases. Say, you know, liver lobe torsion if you suspect abdominal hemorrhage. But otherwise, my main uses for ultrasound are for the urogenital tract. But like with dogs and cats, you can check the usual organs, liver, spleen, adrenal glands, and lymph nodes as well. So just to go through a few images, and I know it's difficult to make black and white images seem really interesting, but I wanted to show just a couple of examples. So we've got the stomach here, and what you can see is this lesion, this structure in this area here, and this is sort of normal wall structure at this point. So this is the stomach, and it can be difficult to get good quality images of the rabbit stomach, mainly because it's always full of either ingestion, fluid or gas or a bit of all of them. And that means that there's always an element of shadowing that the, you know, when we're looking at the views. But this was an abnormal stomach that was actually quite empty. The rabbit presented inappetent. And the view was taken along the greater curvature, where there was a focal area of thickening with some fluid to the gastric mucosa. And this was diagnosed as an ulcer. So, you know, even if you're thinking perhaps you wouldn't reach a diagnosis, having a look for checking for abnormalities, it's always a good idea to do. So if we're thinking about the liver, so, you know, again, if you're talking about doing abdominal ultrasound, having a set plan and cranial to caudal is as good as any. So stomach, fair enough, have a look, see if you can make sense of it or not. The liver is a little bit tricky to access in rabbits. You don't often see all of it because of the stomach being in the way. But it lies immediately behind the diaphragm. You have about two-thirds of the liver on the right, about a third of it on the left, and it's made up of four lobes. And the gallbladder is found deep within the right cranial lobe, so on the right side. And the liver is hypoechoic when you compare it to surrounding structures. And this is an image of a normal liver. And in the normal healthy liver, you can visualize the biliary tree and blood vessels along with the oval-shaped gallbladder. And what we find is that in many overweight rabbits, there's likely to be fat infiltration with a little bit of hepatic lipidosis, so throughout the hepatic parenchyma. And this can increase the echoic properties of the liver. Now, the spleen and the liver, they're quite similar in appearance. However, the echoic properties of the liver in rabbits is slightly lower than that of the spleen. And the spleen, just like other species, it lies along the greater curvature of the stomach, with a portion of it lying cranial to the left kidney. So if we have a look at another image, so remembering what a normal liver can be like, the image to the left, we've got these mineralized foci throughout the hepatic parenchyma. So you can see these kind of sort of shining areas. And this ultrasound image is of a young rabbit that presented with weight loss and lethargy. And blood show elevated bile acids, reduced protein levels, and alk phos was a bit high as well. We did a pooled fecal flotation test, and that showed coccidiosis. And so we diagnosed hepatic coccidiosis. We did take FNAs. They were inconclusive. They just showed hepatocellular damage and inflammation. But this little one unfortunately didn't respond to treatment, so we did do a PM on it, and it confirmed an overwhelming hepatic coccidiosis. So, you know, certainly having a look at the liver, especially in these young inappetent rabbits, is a good idea, and it might just guide you towards, you know, further tests to be performing. Fairly standard views here, but you can just nicely see gallbladder, normal liver structure as well. So again, you can really get these nice images. Bit of sludge here in the gallbladder. Sort of a bit of an incidental finding in this rabbit. We didn't do anything about that one. And then the kidneys, so probably the most common reason I use ultrasonography is to assess the kidneys. And it is important to carry out both a transverse and longitudinal planes view with your probe for the scans. And the kidneys are very similar to dog and cat in appearance. They're smooth in shape and they have a single hilus. And the right kidney is found, as we saw in the radiographic views, it's found in the region of the 11th rib to the sort of second lumbar vertebrae, and it's always more cranial in placement than the left kidney. And the left kidney is more in the area of the second to the fourth lumbar vertebrae. But both kidneys are easy to access for ultrasonography, just making sure that your clipped area extends cranially enough. But rabbit skin is quite stretchy as well. The renal cortex, what can we say about that? Well, that's the outer part, and it has quite a uniform echogenicity. It's a bit hyperechoic when compared to the medulla. And I always check the renal pelvis for any signs of dilation. It's centrally located and it's hyperechoic and usually surrounded by quite hyperechoic peripelvic adipose tissue, so fat basically. And you can see on this view here just the sort of normal sort of outline, normal architecture, nice and smooth of this kidney, with the cortex and the medullary area at this point. And here we can see a big cyst in this rabbit's kidney here. There's quite a bit of proteinuria in the urine, so we thought it may be related to this cyst. But ultimately, we were just monitoring this for now. The rabbit otherwise was clinically sound. And this is an example where we've got the outline of the bladder here. And then this chap here is the stone that's in the picture. So this required a cystotomy for removal. But with the bladder, one thing I would say is be careful not to put too much pressure on, as often the bladder contains only a small amount of urine, and therefore when you compress it, it becomes difficult to see. Do be careful with the probe how much pressure you're putting on. Your calcium carbonate crystals are routinely found in the bladder of rabbits, and it gives a kind of snow globe appearance when you agitate the bladder. And obviously, you can identify bladder stones, and depending on the skill of the ultrasonographer, sometimes you can follow the ureters from kidney to bladder or vice versa. There's often a lot of fat around the neck of the bladder. And obviously, ultrasound does allow you to assess the thickness of the bladder wall as well. Now, if you've got uterine pathology, again, the ultrasound is very useful as a modality for assessing that, far more so than radiography. This, we can clearly see that we've got a lot of fluid material in here in the uterus, and this was a hydrometra. This is what a hydrometra looks like on X-ray, so very nondescript, whereas immediately diagnosed on ultrasound. So if you're suspecting things like that, I would always go ultrasound over radiography because you just lose all the serosal detail because the sheer amount of fluid that's in that uterus. So that's a little hop, step and jump through ultrasonography. And just the last couple of slides just to finish on, more for interest than anything when it comes to CT. So I use a lot of CT up in Edinburgh. We do a lot of conscious CT. We very rarely need to have a situation like this patient where we're anaesthetized. And it basically allows us to get these beautiful 3D images, very high resolution, and be able to assess bone, lung, etc., in really lovely detail. My main uses are for dental disease, for respiratory disease, and ear disease, but we can use it for certainly to identify if we've got a mass on the liver or stones in the bladder. But for its real purposes, the dental workup, respiratory and ear, it's second to none for those. Now, what we do here is we have a little perspex tube. We call it the mouse trap, and you can see this little chap sitting in it. He's nice and secure in there. He's all tied in, and he just goes through our CT scanner. And what the CT does is it takes these nice cross-sectional images. So you can see this blue line at this level here. So what we've got are the cheeks, the upper cheeks, the lower lip, the philtrum, the start of a little bit of white, which is the upper incisor coming into view. And then we've got the nasal septum, a little bit of the frontal bone, and a bit of a scroll of the start of a nostril there as well. As we scroll further back, so this is a post-contrast view, level of the eyeball, eyeball here, and we can quite clearly see the outline of an abscess at this level. These are the cheek teeth, upper and lower arcades there. And we'd need to make a surgical approach just below the eye to remove this and take out the affected tooth, which is what happened for that particular rabbit. Going further back over the lung fields at this point, what can we see? Well, we can see a heart, we can see some vessels, we can see the black of a normal lung field, vertebrae at this point, we've got scapula of the shoulder here. And you can see just how beautiful it is for getting lovely images of this thoracic area. Here we've got an abscess to the lower mandible, where we've got a lysis of the bone on a lateral aspect, and loss of some of the teeth as well. So again, just nice images that we can get to be able to show clients and give prognosis as well. This is just to show what abdomen looks like. So we can see outline of stomach coming all the way around at this point here. We've got the start of the right kidney, this round structure at this point. And this ingesta is quite normal, although a little bit dehydrated in the stomach. And we've got some cecum down at this point here. So lots and lots of uses for CT. And I suppose the thing is that if you have a patient where you want to do a very thorough dental workup, maybe the client's keen to get at least some images as a starting point, then very useful for dental disease. I want to finish on this last slide, which is just to say that for some disease processes like uretitis media, then really ultrasound can be used, and there was a paper I think published by Glasgow Vet School looking at that. But it's also sometimes very difficult to get right, and you need a lot of practice with it. And imaging can be difficult in practice with radiography, because here we have a case where this side here, let me get my little pointer again. So this side is sort of the normal side, if you like, and that's this side here, whereas this side is this side here. And I definitely wouldn't be able to have looked at that radiograph and think that that animal had that level of disease, whereby we've lost the lateral wall of the tympanic bulla. It's no longer gas-filled, it's filled in with material, and we've got a lot of fill of pus and purulent material and wax and debris in the external ear canal as well. So although we have many uses in first opinion practice with radiography and ultrasonography, there are times where you may want to consider referral for CT or even MRI to just be able to provide your clients with that little bit more information for their cases. So any questions from all of that? And I hope that's been helpful for you today. Okay, so just one question, which was, I'd mentioned tramadol as a drug to give rabbits. What dose do I use of that? Well, the dose rates that I generally use, so there's 11 milligrams per kilogram, which can be given once daily by mouth. I tend to go for 5 or 6 milligrams per kilogram twice daily by mouth. And that's what I use for my patients. And obviously warning the owners if they feel that they're a bit more sedate or spaced out, then we might want to reduce the dose. Okay, thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Jenna for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.